Hello, and welcome back to Elder Sign, a weird fiction podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Brandon Buda. In today's episode, we'll be covering Peter Straub's story, maybe? A Short Guide to the City. This was published in 1990. We read it in a collection called Houses Without Doors.
This story was nominated by one of our really awesome Patreon supporters. I want to say a huge thanks for this nomination. We'll talk more about why we're thankful for that in just a few minutes. But yeah, just want to extend our thanks to the Patreon supporter, really all our Patreon supporters who nominate episodes and our Patreon supporters who vote for what we should be talking about here on the show. And speaking of thanks, we also want to thank our sponsor for this episode. This is writer John R. Foltz. Most of you have probably heard of John Foltz before because of his fantasy series, really epic fantasy series called Books of the Shaper. This was out or started being published, I guess, about a decade ago. This was something that I certainly saw going around Sword and Sorcery and also, I guess, Robert E. Howard circles, the books that I read and really, really enjoyed. And of course, these were going around these types of circles because even though it really is an epic fantasy, this series also has a really strong Howardian feel to it. But what we really want to tell you about is that Foltz is out with a brand new book. This is a collection of what we do here. It's weird fiction short stories. The collection is called Darker Than Weird. It's got 14 stories in it. It's actually a pretty big collection, I will say. And Foltz was kind enough to send us an advanced copy to read. And there is a lot of great work in this book. I really like it. One story, I guess, that I will draw your attention to, though, is The Rude Mechanicals and the Highwayman. Now, my attention, of course, was drawn to this because of the reference to A Midsummer Night's Dream there in the title. And that comes into play because the story is about a troupe of actors as they travel through what I guess I would describe as something, maybe not quite, but something akin to Lovecraft's Dreamlands. It's got, you know, winged fungi and other like fun features like that, different realms that you can go to. But it is also actually an incredibly creepy story. Just as an example, I'll try to be not spoilery here, but just as an example, the Highwayman is also known as the Surgeon, and just nobody should have that nickname, right? If you don't want to creep people out. But also, I will say that the plot definitely takes some cues from Soylent Green. So this is a story from this collection that I highly recommend. Brandon, what grabbed your attention from this collection?
Well, I read Love in the Time of Dracula, and I absolutely loved it. The timing of me reading this story was great. I recently went to a book signing for Justin Cronin's newest book called The Ferryman, and he wrote the trilogy called The Passage Trilogy, it's sometimes called. It's a vampire apocalypse series. I loved those books. I think Justin Cronin is an amazing writer. And this story, Love in the Time of Dracula, happens to be a vampire apocalypse story. So this was already on my mind. Foltz does an amazing job of giving us this sense of a world that has just been overrun by vampires to the point of maybe even hopelessness. And there is hope here in this story. It's a hope you don't see coming. It's a wonderful story, kind of like a squad against vampires in New York City feel to it. There's so much here to commend. The writing is a blast. It is smooth. It brings you right to the conclusion that you probably won't see coming. I loved it. I am so excited to dig into the rest of this collection. And I know we're going to be plugging this for a few episodes. This is well worth your time. I can't wait to talk about more of these stories.
Yeah, I think it's interesting as well that you and I each were drawn rather immediately to, just, you know, in looking through the table of contents, the stories that have literary allusions in their titles.
Right, of course.
Which makes sense. And I should say that there are more of them here as well. A lot of the stories have literary allusions in the titles. I expect more of that in the stories as well, if, you know, that is your jam. It certainly is our jam, as I think we've clearly demonstrated here. But yeah, so we hope that you'll check out Darker Than Weird by John R. Foltz. We have, of course, put some links in the show notes to make that real easy for you. But yeah, let's turn our attention here to our Peter Straub story, Brandon. And we should say right away that this Peter Straub story was nominated by one of our Patreon supporters right after Straub's passing was announced in the autumn of 2022. So about a year ago now, at least as listeners are hearing this episode. And because of that, because his death is rather recent, I thought it might be nice then to actually just start this episode by talking about our personal histories with Peter Straub's work? And I guess the better radio thing to do, Brandon, is to actually make that a question for you. So, Brandon, what is your experience with Peter Straub's work?
Well, I think the first time I came across Peter Straub's name was in his collaborations with Stephen King. I was deep into the Dark Tower series when I was 18 and 19. A friend of mine in the Army read all of those books together. I guess the fifth one, Wolves of the Kala, was coming out. And then we just kind of like created our own little book club and started talking in King speak from the Dark Tower series. I don't know. It was a whole thing at the time. And so Straub had written some novels with Stephen King that were connected to that world. Now, I haven't read those novels, much to my shame, but years later in Colorado, I picked up Ghost Story and immediately fell in love with that novel as a horror novel, and kind of didn't pick up Straub for a little while after that. I just kept on rereading Ghost Story. But in the past couple years, I have read Straub's Blue Rose trilogy. I'm going to talk a lot more about that later as we get into this story we're covering today, for reasons that will become clear when I bring it up. But the Blue Rose trilogy blew me away, especially the second two books. And Straub quickly became, I don't know, someone who I really admire deeply as a writer and their projects and their mind. Straub's passing hit me pretty hard. And he's someone who I'm going to read everything they've written over the course of my own lifetime. So yeah, I guess you could say I am really, really love Peter Straub's writing. I really admire him as a craftsman. And I hope we get a chance to talk a little bit about his craft here in this story as we go through A Short Guide to the City today.
Well, our story is basically the same. And in fact, I remember when you were reading Ghost Story, we talked about it very, very briefly at that point. And in fact, you were reading it, in the same situation I was. For me, it was 1999. I found Ghost Story on a horror story display at my local branch of the Denver Public Library. I read that. It's a masterpiece. Loved it. Didn't read it again right away. But then what I did was binge everything that Straub had written up to that point. In fact, I had a lot of those as mass market paperbacks that I would keep in my cargo pocket of my Army uniform. And then, you know, the culture at the place that you and I used to work at was that people would take 10 to 15 minute smoke breaks, you know, 4 or 5 times a day. So I was frequently in the habit as a non-smoker of taking reading breaks, not 4 or 5 times a day, but 10 minute reading breaks, you know, once in the morning, once in the afternoon, sit outside and refresh before going back to our really pretty incredibly stressful job. And that was a big part of how I read, like worked my way all the way through Peter Straub's work. So I love his work on its own, but it is also viscerally connected to that particular experience of my life. But then a few years later, you came to that facility in the military as well, and you were reading Ghost Story and talking about it at work, which inspired me to read it again around Halloween in 2010. But, you know, that's almost 15 years ago now, and I have not read any Peter Straub since. But like you, the news of his passing really affected me, and we talked, whenever it was that we recorded him, you know, next after hearing that news, we said, we need to do some Peter Straub. And in fact, we had already decided that we would do some, and I'll let listeners know what that's going to be, which is that our plan is to cover Ghost Story, this book that was our gateway to Peter Straub and also just a masterpiece that we absolutely love. We are going to be covering that on Patreon as our regular Patreon Halloween episode this year. I guess it's not a regular, it's a bonus Halloween episode, but yeah, we'll be doing that. So if you're into Peter Straub and you're with us on Patreon, you'll get access to that. And that is something I'm really, really, really excited to do. But then I was delighted when we also got a nomination from this, that our listeners, or at least one of our listeners, is on the same page with us here.
Yeah, this has been a real pleasure. This reading this story, A Short Guide to the City, brought me right back into The Throat, which is the final novel of the Blue Rose trilogy, and really got me excited again about reading Ghost Story. I knew we were going to do it. We've been kind of snowed under with novels this year so far, so I kind of haven't been forecasting ahead to Ghost Story. But reading this just reminded me all of the things that I really love about Straub's prose, which I think Ghost Story is a little bit more poetic in some of its prose techniques than this story is, and then the Blue Rose trilogy is. I think there's a purpose for that. And when we cover Ghost Story, I hope to be able to make some real comparisons between these different periods of Straub's writing career, because he Ghost Story was written in, what, 79 or something, it was published. And this is 1990. So he's grown a lot as a writer and really kind of nailed down his voice and technique in different ways. And so, yeah, I guess we should really just talk about A Short Guide to the City.
Right, yeah, let's get into it. And here's the thing about this story, is that it is exactly what it says in the title. And in fact, as you alluded to, and just even saying what it is we're going to be covering today, this really isn't a story in a technical sense, right? It's not about a person or group of people who are attempting to achieve some kind of objective in the face of obstacles that they have to overcome. I guess that's at least my technical definition of a story. This piece is not that. And so to that end, we are not going to use our standard format today. Instead, what we'll do is, well, I'll give something of a synopsis, then we'll expand on that together. And after that, we will talk about what bit of plot, or at least what bit of action or activity there is in this story. And then we will finish up by talking about this story in the context of other Peter Straub works. Brandon has just invoked that there, but also some other stories that we have covered on the show. So, all right, the city in question, the city that we are going to get a guide for here, is an unnamed American city. In fact, it's very clearly in the upper Midwest. I mean, Straub says that it is, but even if he didn't ever say that, it would be really obvious. And I guess I also should be clear here that this city is not a real place. Straub has made it up, and that will become evident shortly. And one of the elements that makes this city so obviously a city in the upper Midwest is the climate. Deathly cold in the winter, cloyingly hot and humid in the summer. The city is also situated on a lake. There's also a river that runs through it. It also has two newspapers. One of them is Democratic, the other one Republican. But both newspapers support the current mayor. The current mayor has been the current mayor for decades. The city also boasts a handful of famous citizens. One of them is a Hollywood staple. There's another one who later went on to become the head of a small independent country. And so you might immediately be thinking that, well, that's a description of Chicago. I certainly was. Chicago's my hometown. But it eventually becomes clear that this is, in fact, a much smaller community. And also, Straub wrote this story before anyone living in Chicago actually did go on to become the head of a small independent country in the early 1990s. So that really was blowing my mind there. But at any rate, it's not actually Chicago. We do never get any precise numbers about, you know, the size of this community, but I think it probably makes more sense to think of not so much someplace like Chicago, but maybe someplace like Madison, Wisconsin. And I think, Brandon, that's as far as I'll take us here in setting up the city, because I think from this point, Straub really takes us on a journey through the city's neighborhoods, talking about its human culture, also its architecture and urban planning. So I think this is a good place for us to move into the conversational part of the episode. And let's talk first about the human society before we talk about the materiality of the city. Straub certainly fills this city with some weird cultures, really some weird fiction cultural elements and social elements here. What was your favorite, Brandon?
Well, I can't help but to filter my reading of this story through having read The Throat, I guess, within the past year and a half. And I'll talk about that, like I said, in a little bit. We have space for that on the outline. But as it pertains to human society, I want to focus on the working class drinking establishments in the city, where you should go, where you should avoid, should you be a tourist. And that's kind of how this story is set up. It's if you're a tourist in this city, if you find yourself in, I'll call it not Milwaukee, in the Blue Rose, it's called Millhaven, Illinois. Clearly modeled on these two cities. The Milwaukee bit is kind of important, I think, as we'll see when we see kind of the narrative elements of this story. But just keep in mind the Jeffrey Dahmer murders that took place in Milwaukee as being something on Straub's mind, perhaps. But one of the reasons why this, the Irish drinking scene, the Polish drinking scene, the Green Woman tap room, the kind of children who hang out and throw rocks at maybe a very old man with wings here in this part of the area of the city. One of the reasons why all of this jumped out to me is the way that the Blue Rose novels in particular kind of carry on this style of writing or this movement from the 1950s and 60s in Britain, which is called like the kitchen sink movement or the kitchen sink novel, which is about social realism. Usually these movements, these novels in particular or plays are looking at the lives of disillusioned or angry young men living unfulfilled lives, hanging out in dive bars, and the society that forms these men. And even though this kitchen sink movement is rooted in post-war British class issues, a lot of its themes fit really well in the post-war American suburb experience as well. And this is, you know, something that has been co-opted, I think, until the mid-90s, I suppose, with writers like John Updike and Raymond Carver, maybe Richard Yates as well. This kind of dissatisfaction with life in the Midwest, in the suburbs, that you're looking at class in America in a way that's about dissatisfaction, and that often leads these men to become take risks, right? That's kind of the conflict of these novels, is this level of risk-taking behavior where like a good suburban man might go to a rough part of the city and get drunk and meet a prostitute or something like that. Or there's all sorts of things that could happen. It could be mild risk-taking, could be extreme risk-taking. But it's usually connected somehow to male dissatisfaction and male rage. And all of that is kind of really put into focus in these working class drinking parts of this tour of the city. There's places where you can go and you can be safe, but you'd be risking if you're an outsider going there. There's places where you might go and might be welcome, but it's still a rough place to be. And so I really liked that. I really, like I said, this is all filtered through my having read the Blue Rose trilogy, but I really love the way that even in these brief sections of the story, that's still here, that kind of kitchen sink feel of maybe male rage and dissatisfaction and violence that's kind of tied up in a dirty bar or a dive bar. I love dive bars. So I don't know. I loved this part of the story. I think Straub did a really incredible job, especially in the way that this story has this pulse beat of violence towards women, kind of, I don't know, threading through it is the wrong one, but just beating through A Short Guide to the City.
Right. Yeah. We have a whole segment of the episode where we're going to talk about that, because that really is the through line here. To the extent that there is any kind of action happening, it is murder, specifically murdering women, and violence, generally speaking, is what this guide is about. One of the things that the narrator of this guide is doing is commenting on the violent attributes of the people who live in different sectors, different neighborhoods in this city, which is a remarkable way to write a guide. Speaking of suburbs, that we do get a funny line where the guide tells us, well, if you go that way too far, you'll just end up in the suburbs, which are not interesting. So don't go there.
Right,
and that felt very poignant. That felt, you know, very much like something written in the late 1980s and then published in 1990 to me.
Absolutely. Yeah. That whole feeling of being, you know, once I was a man and now I'm picking out curtains and this is my life, and what I used to drink and fight, you know, or something like that. Or if you're looking at the 80s and 90s, as Straub is, you're looking at Vietnam vets who are now caught in this really dull and mundane existence, picking out curtains and wondering, like, how did I go from fighting a war to this? You know, is this the track my life was always on? And I guess we call that a midlife crisis, but that exploration of it, especially caught up in being an ex-soldier, is something that interests me, you know, personally, for probably obvious reasons, for people who have been listening to the show for a long time.
Right. And of course, especially when we're thinking about Peter Straub, who we have both just told everybody we read when we were in the army, right? So yeah, this matters to us. You know, it's a connection that matters to us there. Yeah, there's a lot of brilliant stuff going on in the culture and society of this city. In fact, narrowing it down to just one that I wanted to present to our audience was incredibly difficult. But I decided to pick one where Well, I want to lean into something that you said you hoped that we would do, which is to talk about Straub's skill, his writing craft here. I'm actually just going to read an entire paragraph of this story into the microphone here, because I think it's so amazing. The Southsiders live in a profound relationship to violence, and its effects are invariably implosive rather than explosive. Once a decade, perhaps twice a decade, one member of a family will realize, out of what depths of cultural necessity the outsider can only hope to imagine, that the whole family must die, be sacrificed, to speak with greater accuracy. Axes, knives, bludgeons, bottles, babushkas, ancient derringers, virtually every imaginable implement has been used to carry out this aim. The houses in which this act of sacrifice has taken place are immediately, if not instantly, cleaned by the entire neighborhood acting in concert. The bodies receive a Catholic burial in consecrated ground, and a mass is said in honor of both the victims and their murderer. A picture of the departed family is installed in the church which abuts Market Square, and for a year, the house is kept clean and dust-free by the grandmothers of the neighborhood. Men, young and old, will quietly enter the house, sip the brandy of the removed, as they are called, meditate, now and then switch on the wireless or the television set, and reflect on the darkness of earthly life. The departed are frequently said to appear to friends and neighbors, and often accurately predict the coming of storms and assist in the location of lost household objects, a treasured button or mother's sewing needle. After the year has elapsed, the house is sold, most often to a young couple, a young blacksmith or market vendor and his bride, who find the furniture and even the clothing of the removed welcome additions to their small household. So yeah, this is weird, right? This is a weird cultural tradition. I mean, it's not maybe a bizarre cultural tradition in terms of how a community might respond to the death of one of its members to cherish their memory, to make their home continue to be a part of the community in this way and to share ghost stories about them and so on. It's the acceptance of once or twice a decade, somebody murders their whole family as part of our culture. That is deeply unsettling, but it is presented here just as a feature of this town that you might be visiting on vacation. And it's brilliant.
It is so brilliant. This feature of Straub's prose here, of his style in this period of his writing, is something, even as I was reading this story, I felt my mind kind of unspooling in some way, by which I mean my mind is always reaching for my phone to some degree or for a new tab on the computer or something like that. And Straub's, the rhythm of his prose here, the matter-of-factness of it, the detail that is alarming and non-judgmental at the same time, the maybe even stylelessness of it. There's no overt flashy style to his prose. It's just steady and matter of fact and presents information without judgment. Like, it has this effect on me where just if I stay in the rhythm of it, my brain cleans all of that other stuff out. Like, so that's a feature of Straub's prose that I really love. This, and I don't really know quite how else to describe it. Styleless almost sounds like a critique or a criticism, but I think it's very intentional. There's a very steady hand behind the person who's writing this, you know, and it's there's a comforting element to it. I don't know. Am I making any sense here, Glenn?
Yeah, this makes sense to me. And I will say that this particular piece really does read like a style of travel writing that was popular in at least the late 80s and certainly through the 90s. It was a style of travel writing that I think I probably encountered most frequently in the Atlantic, back when it was called the Atlantic Monthly, where, yeah, you would get these like 12 to 20 page pieces about intrepid reporter visiting some community somewhere, you know, around the world, some place that would be interesting in an exotic sense to Americans mostly. Although also sometimes going to places in America and writing about them through that same lens. That's really what this felt like to me. This felt almost kind of like a pastiche of that type of writing. I don't know that that's a genre that has survived the advent of the internet, but this was a big feature of news and entertainment or news and arts magazines at the time that Straub was writing this. And it's perfect. It's a perfect mimic of that.
It is. It's. I guess it's like anti-Gonzo, which I guess is a weird way to say it. It's like trying to maintain objectivity while examining things that are horrific, right? And like you don't want to insert yourself into that as a writer, as a person with journalistic standards, unless you're doing a Gonzo piece. But there's that tension. Somehow Straub captures this desire to want to know more. That kind of drives his writing, the compelling nature of his writing, while maintaining this kind of objectivity of tone. It's a real feat. I mean, like, I've spent a lot of time thinking about what Straub is doing with style in these novels, in this story, and I haven't cracked it. And maybe it's much more simple than I'm giving him credit for here, but it does not seem simple what he's pulled off here at all to me.
Well, let's move away from talking about the human element of this city and talk about the material element of the city, which I think is equally weird. What jumped out to you here in terms of physical features of this upper Midwestern city?
Well, I want to talk about what Straub terms the ghetto here. I think it's pretty fascinating for a number of reasons. One is the use of the term ghetto, that he doesn't ascribe any kind of racist element to. This is just maybe a low socioeconomic status of this section of the city. He kind of wants to ignore it, but it's a zoned part of the city, but it feels walled in, right? And like people don't actually go in or leave. And maybe the people who live there are forced to live there due to dire economic situations. Maybe there is some racially motivated zoning to keep a certain race in there or a certain race out of the rest of the city. That's called redlining. That has happened in U.S. cities a lot in the past. But what Straub really focuses on here instead is twofold. First is that this insular part of the city that might actually be walled in is full of culture. He talks about people whose job it is to keep local history. There's a lot of local artists. And it really feels like he's using this word ghetto to describe like the bohemian part of this city. And Straub resists giving any other kind of demographic description other than like a lot of cool artists live here, right? And the historians, but no one really gets in or out. And I said it was twofold, but that might have been a mistake. It's really just onefold. What really interests me here is the walls and then the way he focuses on the culture in this insular part of the city more than any other kind of demographic information that you might expect when someone describes something as a ghetto. But really, he's not focused on it. And he tells people, if you are going to go there, drive through, don't walk through.
Right. In order to get into this ghetto, you actually have to pay a toll at a gatehouse, right? So there very definitely is like walls in a sense that goes way beyond the actual practice of redlining, which it really just uses different types of zoning laws and also maybe puts interstates or other types of busy roads around neighborhoods or to cordon off neighborhoods or even just to make neighborhoods that would then later be called ghettos in cities in the 1980s and the 1990s. But this has like an actual genuine wall, the way that a medieval European ghetto would have walls. But another thing that's happening here, just in terms of the material culture that I found really fascinating with the ghetto, is that there are tents that have like hospitals in them. There are drug warehouses that are also in tents. There's grocery stores that also are in tents. It seems like this is a walled community of people who are mostly living in tents. Like it's a walled off area of the city that maybe doesn't have a lot of buildings in it. And it seems like, although Straub doesn't point this out, it seems like the reason for this has something to do with the civic disturbances of 1968, which is, of course, a real time when there were civic disturbances all over America, though I tend to think of that as being most especially Chicago, where many of the buildings burned. And so my sense was that the ghetto is a part of the city that had been burnt down and then not rebuilt. And so people are living in there in this tent city, essentially, and have also basically set up their own system, their own government in there, where they actually charge you money to come into it.
Yeah, it's really fascinating what Straub has come up here. And like, this is maybe, there's a few really strange things in this guide to the city. And this description of the ghetto, I think, is one that is in that top list of very strange things in this city. What did you find, Glenn? What jumped out to you in terms of the, physical material features of this city?
Well, I'm going to cheat here, Brandon, and I'm going to give listeners two. I'll explain why when I do the second one. But the first thing I want to do is just read a description of the valley. And that's really what I want to do. I just want us to appreciate Straub's descriptive writing here. If from the war memorial, you proceed south, you cross the viaduct. Beneath you is a valley. The valley is perhaps best seen in the dead of winter. All of our city welcomes winter, for our public buildings are gray stone fortresses, which, on days when the temperature dips below zero and the old gray snow of previous storms swirls in the avenues, seem to blend with the leaden air and become dreamlike and cloudy. This is how they were meant to be seen. The valley is called, the valley. Red flames tilt and waver at the tops of columns, and smoke pours from factory chimneys. The trees seem to be black. In the winter, the smoke from the factories becomes solid, like dark gray glaciers, and hangs in the dark air in defiance of gravity, like wings that are a light feathery gray at their tips and darken imperceptibly toward black, toward pitchy black at the point where these great frozen glaciers, these dirigibles, would join the body at the shoulder. The bodies of the great birds to which these wings are attached must be imagined. And this, I just thought, was a beautiful, if grotesque as well, description of industry. This actually also felt like it could be describing part of Chicago, not the valley part, but the smokestacks and the winter part of it, that really just made this city feel like a real physical place that you and I could go visit, where it, you know, draws on real places that exist, that I have seen, that also live in my imagination and in my memory, but also giving it some kind of distinctness here. And I also just love the rhythm and the cadence of that. I'm not sure that my reading did real justice to that, but there's just a real poetry to this otherwise very prosy description of a place that you might visit.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that the real feature of Straub's prose here, if we're going to look at like any kind of poetic technique, is rhythm. There is such a steady rhythm to it that when you're reading it, it draws you in this incredible way, and kind of the descriptions stick with you because so much else is plain in his prose, that the descriptions just kind of pop in these great ways. And that, I'm really glad you read that. I mean, this whole story is just such a pleasure to read. And there's so many great descriptions of different parts of the city. But that look at industry in winter and why brutalist architecture might work in a certain part of the city or a certain when of the city, like a season, it's all there. It's wonderful. Straub's given so much thought to the sense of place here, and it's a real treat.
And that was a part of the city, or at least a description, that was not particularly fantastical. And so I want to share another one here that is. I'm not actually going to read this. This I'll just talk about. But this is also something that straddles sort of both of our categories here, the human element and also the material element. And it is that Straub has populated this city with another type of independent community. But this is a children's city in the downtown area. And what's going on here is that children have occupied some of the vacant lots that are there. And in fact, these lots are sandwiched between porn shops and fast food restaurants. And the kids have constructed dwellings on these vacant lots. And some of them are called tree houses, though they aren't actually in trees. What they are towers, really big towers made of tires. And I am super interested in these dwellings. Like, can you just, imagine that? But one of the things I think that really makes this stand out for me is the idea that there are just kids living on their own in really what sounds to me an awful lot like the South Loop of the 1980s. And these kids even have their own gift shops where they will sell you postcards of their tire towers, their tree houses, the physical features of this community that they have established. But just all I can do when I read this is wonder who the heck are these kids and where are their parents?
Right. Yeah. I mean, their parents are probably at the Green Woman tap room or something like that, or working in the breweries or in the factories. And, you know, everybody's too tired to keep track of the fifth kid who's running around. You know, maybe they don't need an education after all. You know, there's a lot of humor in that. And this kind of, I think people love, and maybe this is an American culture thing, though probably not, but people love the idea of kids getting up to kid business, you know, especially in groups. There's a danger there. There's a dangerous mischief there. But then there's also this other industriousness that's like a pure reflection of the society that they live in. And I think Straub has captured that in this description of these little kid cities that, you know, where they've built their own tree houses and selling postcards. They're imitating what adults do, but they're doing it in their own kid way. And the advice for the tourist is don't go over there and don't give them money. Like, you know, that's, we don't want to perpetuate this, but I don't know. Maybe you do want a postcard of a treehouse.
Yeah, I think this is actually the place that I would go to first. It really seemed to me to be the coolest place. And I guess also as soon as someone's telling me not to do a thing, you know, that just makes me want to do the thing. But yeah, this felt like, you know, it was Neverland, except Neverland as envisioned by someone, you know, living in the city of broad shoulders, more or less, right? It felt like a very American, 20th century American idea of what a Neverland would be like. It's mostly just towers of tires that kids are living in, which feels right to me.
Yeah, it certainly does. Again, like Straub's powers of observation, not just on the descriptive writing level, but also in terms of imagining, you know, what it could be, what things could be, or just they're unrivaled. I mean, he is a real master. Like I said, I mean, I have just nothing but a huge amount of admiration for Peter Straub as a writer.
Well, now let's go talk about the murders. That's actually a big feature of this story. And here again, I'm just going to read into the microphone. It's really just kind of been my MO this story because it's just so good. Now, here's the opening paragraph of the story. The viaduct killer, named for the location where his victims' bodies have been discovered, is still at large. There have been 6 victims to date, found by children, people exercising their dogs, lovers, or, in one instance, by policemen. The bodies lay sprawled, their throats slashed, partially sheltered by one or another of the massive concrete supports at the top of the slope beneath the Great Bridge. We assume that the viaduct killer is a resident of the city, a voter, a renter or property owner, a product of the city's excellent public school system, perhaps even a parent of children who even now attend one of its 7 elementary schools, 3 public high schools, 2 parochial schools, or single non-denominational private school. He may own a boat or belong to the Book of the Month Club. He may frequent one or another of its many bars and taverns. He may have subscription tickets to the concert series put on by the City Symphony Orchestra. He may be a factory worker with a library ticket. He owns a car, perhaps 2. He may swim in one of the city's public pools or the vast lake, punctuated with sailboats during the hot, moist August of the city. And as I said earlier, the rest of the guide is really organized around trying to figure out which community this serial killer comes from. And so as the guide takes us into each neighborhood, or at least each sector or segment of the city, there is the central question of its inhabitants' relationship to violence. And although we return to this at the end of the piece, there's no actual resolution to this. This is not a mystery that is solved. The writer of this guide doesn't draw any conclusions, even after giving us this tour of this place. And I guess the question I have here, Brandon, is just, what do you make of this? Is this just a clever and morbid storytelling device, or is there something thematic happening here?
Well, I think the kitchen sink nature of the broader, like, Blue Rose trilogy, of which this is a part of, perhaps could be considered a part of, lends itself to investigating kind of male rage and violence, you know, dissatisfied men who take their rage out on women and so forth. But I feel like I have to pause now. We have to pause now and talk about the Blue Rose trilogy a little bit, particularly The Throat, which Straub was writing as this was coming out. So this collection, Houses Without Doors, came out while Straub was taking on this four-year endeavor. It took him 4 years to write The Throat, from what I understand, which is the third novel in this trilogy. And that 4 years kind of shows in every sentence and every page of that novel. The style of that novel is written in the exact same style as A Short Guide to the City. Many of the places in A Short Guide to the City feature in a big way in Straub's city of Millhaven, Illinois, which is really a fictional Milwaukee. And as I said, if we're thinking about Milwaukee, then we have to think about Jeffrey Dahmer in The Throat. There's this huge relationship between, there's actually maybe two serial killers in the city with entirely different motivations. One is more Dahmer-esque, one is more methodical, like this viaduct killer. And so Straub is in some ways thinking about the ways that profiling works, but the way in that place might contribute to the nature of crimes. He's looking at post-Vietnam era America and what's happened to the men who have succeeded in terms of the American dream, but are kind of lagging in other areas as a result of the trauma of their service. So what this story then feels like to me, the viaduct killer, I should say, if I didn't say already, does show up in The Throat in a very important way. But what this all says to me is that this story is a writing exercise that Straub did for himself to get him into his own setting, where he might want to visit, what his characters are into, what are the places that he's going to put in the novel so that he can just sit down and write. And so this to me, this introduction of the killer here as the pulse beat of A Short Guide to the City is part of that exercise. And I mean, if you're a big enough writer to publish essentially a writing exercise in a short story collection, that is, I mean, that's the power of, that's what writers were, these popular writers were in the late 80s and early 90s. Like you could get this done. You'd say, well, I wrote this sketch of the city that I'm setting my next novel in, and your publisher would be like, great, just, I don't know, tie it together in some way and get it over to me. We'll put it in your next short story collection while we're waiting on your big novel. You know, so that's what this story feels like then, is this real tie to The Throat and Straub investigating in his own mind just what the city is, because he's a tourist there, even as he's the creator of it.
I mean, essentially what you're describing here, Brandon, is what's called discovery writing, right? This is where you as the writer are discovering what your story is, discovering what your setting is, discovering who your characters are through the act of writing. But it's writing that doesn't actually belong in the story because it's not working in any kind of service of the plot. And of course, a mistake that so many writers make is to leave that in. I am one of them. I'm perhaps the most flagrant.
I think we both
one of them.
Are, Glenn.
Yeah. I mean, it's because it's what we love. And so for me, even as a reader, I love to get this writing that is actually just the discovery writing excised from any kind of plot, which is, you know, my least favorite or least compelling component of any type of, you know, storytelling is the plot for me, and just get this guide. And yeah, I yearn for a publishing market where writers can actually just publish their discovery writing as standalone pieces. That's a magazine I would subscribe to.
Yeah, I know. That would be so great. I mean, I think I have 1,000 pages of this, you know, between hard drives and notebooks that, you know, if someone wants to buy it, I don't know. I guess I could sell it for a penny a word. I'd be happy to. But yeah, no, this bit that Straub is up to here really is, this is discovery writing at its best, with real intent, with a fully formed understanding of where you want to go with the story, but kind of having to write it to yourself, write the city to yourself. There's a writer called David Mitchell. He's most well known for having written Cloud Atlas, which I have not read, but I did read The Bone Clocks, which I found to be pretty impressive. And I was reading interviews with him. And one thing that he does for his discovery writing is to have his characters write letters to him about themselves in their voice. He doesn't have his characters do that, obviously, because you know, they're fictional, but he will do that kind of to get into that character headspace. And so there's all these kinds of great techniques that really, really strong writers do that you just never see. You never see the number of pages that don't make it into the novel. And to me, this is a real gift almost to have a story like this from Peter Straub, to see the pages that didn't make it into the novel, to see his process as a writer, and even how good he is at his sketches, you know?
And this type of writing is a big feature, I think, of really the foundation, the bedrock of weird fiction, of what we cover here on the story. And I guess specifically what I'm thinking about is really the writers who published in Weird Tales. Of course, certainly not all of them, but a lot of these writers who were publishing in Weird Tales in the interwar years were frequently envisioning settings, envisioning places that were weird or interesting in some other ways, you know, speculative, right? And writing up descriptions of them. And that was enough to get published in Weird Tales. We have actually not read too many of those, but one that we have covered is by Clark Ashton Smith. This is the story called A Night in Malneant, which is just envisioning this town called Malneant, there for one night. It's a stranger, right? Taking a tour of this town, telling us a lot about what it looks like, though also does visit a bar. There is some plot stuff there going on with the death of a former lover and so on. But that was an episode. That was a story for which we talked about, you know, the lack of a plot and just reading that as a kind of gazetteer. My recollection is that I really, really loved that story and you really, really did not. But it sounds to me, Brandon, like you really loved this piece. So I wonder where is it here in the story, or what is it in this story that Straub is doing, or this piece, maybe I should say, that Straub is doing that Clark Ashton Smith wasn't doing for you?
For me, it's because I know what this piece is, right? What Straub's piece is. Like, I've read The Throat. I'm very familiar with this place. So for me, this was revisiting a place that I had spent a lot of time in mentally as kind of a tourist and from this new perspective. And so it was just a real pleasure. I mean, there's a term, I can't quite recall it, the exact word, but the description of it is when a tourist comes to your town and tells you all of the things that they love about it and reminds you of the place you live in from a different perspective that makes you love it even more, right? Or makes you see it from a perspective of joy instead of mundanity or something like that. And this story was that for me. This was a revisiting of a place that I had spent a lot of time in, but without any of the horror baggage and terror baggage that Straub had put in The Throat, and just kind of reacquainting myself, seeing a place from a new perspective, a place that I loved. And so that's what did it for me. A Night in Malneant was too much of a setting, I think, for my taste, just too much of a setting without anything attached to it. And so that's the difference for me. It might not be fair play. Of course, a lot of my feelings are involved in making these judgments here. But that's just, I don't know, what can I do? That's just where I'm at here.
Yeah, well, I'm fascinated by that answer because, although, of course, I also have read The Throat, as I said at the top of the show, that was 25 years ago and didn't remember that this had anything to do with that at all. I mean, you had told me before, you know, we hopped on the air, so I was aware of it coming in today, but couldn't remember any of those connections. So for me, these stories were exactly the same thing. They were, here's an imaginary setting. I'm going to take you on a tour of it. There will be a little bit of a plot. In fact, there's actually more plot in the Clark Ashton Smith story. There's more plot in A Night in Malneant than there is here. And I knew you loved this. I could tell that just from the tone of your correspondence, our back and forth about the outline and so on, when we were talking about breaking the normal format and so on, that you loved this story. And so that's why I had to throw this question on here. But so yeah, I'm fascinated that for you, it is actually about not encountering this just as a kind of random pitch for a setting, but as an appendage to something that's already familiar to you, where, of course, the original audience for this story couldn't have read it that way, right? This is something you can do because you've read them out of publication order, right? And so that's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, of course, yeah, that is the weird feature of time, you know, is that we have this great archive of things that we encounter sometimes without context. And when we're reading this or that, I mean, this story with the context of something that wasn't published when it came out, that's crazy. I mean, that's crazy. That's what time is, though. And so, yeah, I think that was a big part of it. I think I would have loved this story, though, had I even not read the throat, I think I would have read it maybe in the more in the vein of like Looking for Jake or another Mievel story, who's another person who excels at that kind of city setting. And for some reason it would have, it's the contemporariness, I think, also that appeals to me, because Mievel does that too, where he has these kind of contemporary feeling settings, as opposed to Clark Ashton Smith's, whose dream world is maybe not a place I'd like to visit. Maybe that's another way to put it. I don't know if I'd ever feel anything other than a sense of nightmare at Clark Ashton Smith's dreams. Whereas like Mievel or Straub's dreams, while the nightmares are there, I think I could navigate them.
Well, I think that's an excellent assessment of the differences here. What, right? A Night in Malneant is essentially Clark Ashton Smith imagining what it would have been like if Edgar Allan Poe had written epic fantasy novels. And like, here's an excerpt from it, basically, right? Whereas what you're talking about here with Straub and then also with China Mieville is descriptions of places that are relevant to you, that you live in, right? So there's actually an element of the fantastical that is removed there, where, yeah, I think maybe a way to think about that is that the A Night in Malneant just is too much fantasy for your tastes, at least your tastes in this type of writing, a guidebook type of writing.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. And I think that's right. I think in discovery writing, when it comes to pure fantasy, I skim. And so that's the thing. You can't skim Peter Straub. You know, he's very difficult to skim. I can skim Clark Ashton Smith. And it's those fantasy elements, I think. And it's the same thing happens when, you know, reading, you know, a doorstopper fantasy novel. When you come to a section that you're like, this is going to be 600 words of discovery writing, it's a different feel, you know, than the action of the plot and so forth. And yeah, I think that's probably a taste note that I hadn't articulated for myself, about myself. But hey, these stories have gotten us there.
Yeah, that's our book therapy segment for the day, I guess, right? little bit of self-discovery through thinking about what stories we like and what stories we don't like, which actually, yeah, that's a huge part of what literature is for, art and literature, right? So excellent. But I think that is probably a good place for us to bring this episode to a close. I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Brandon Buda. Thanks again for listening to this episode. We hope you enjoyed it. If you liked what we did here, you can find us and our other creative projects, our other podcasts at claytemplemedia.com. We hope you'll check us out there, and we really hope you'll go over to patreon.com/claytemplemedia to hear our Halloween episode on Peter Straub's ghost story. Also 200 other episodes to go through if you join us there. Tons of features on Patreon, a lot of good stuff for you. So please at least check out the website, you know, find things you might want to listen to, and consider donating to our cause here.
Yeah. And if you are a big Peter Straub fan, you know, if Peter Straub is really what drew you here and it perhaps draws you to check out the Patreon, hey, look, we would love to be covering more Peter Straub, as we said at the top of the show. So I hope Patreon supporters who have ability to nominate stories will perhaps let us know some more of their favorite Peter Straub stories to cover in the future. Before we go, we want to thank John R. Foltz again for sponsoring this episode of Elder Sign. We very much hope you will check out his new short story collection called Darker Than Weird. You can use the links in the show notes, or you can just look for it wherever you get your books. Next time on the show, we will be back with, in fact, something that was published in Weird Tales, though not something that does this. This is going to be a Seabury Quinn mystery story called The House of Horror. And until then, we greet you and say farewell.